This interview is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. In Practice is an independent publisher, and all opinions expressed by guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of In Practice.
Let's begin this episode on LIFCO and Halma as part of our IP Fieldwork podcast series. Let's begin with a bit of time travel. Take us back, Will, to the first time you came across Halma and LIFCO.
A good long time ago. Probably Halma first, actually. But I think it wasn't exactly a unique way that I came across them. I think the performance of each of the companies speaks for itself. And then if you sprinkle in a bit of obsession with holding companies that actually compound, you know, it leads you to take a deep look at both of these businesses and a few others. What's fascinating is just the overarching question between organic and inorganic growth. And I think the reason why I've spent so much time on these businesses, LIFCO, Halma, Danaher, you know, Berkshire, obviously, and Constellation, but you know, the LIFCO, the Nordic industrial acquirers, the reason why I spent so much time is because of that question between how do you think about inorganic versus organic growth. And the reality, one perspective at least, that I can relate to, or at least make sense in my mind, is that it's very, very difficult to compound organically only for decades. Like, just imagine our business, for example. Okay, how do you compound that organically at higher rates of organic growth? I'm not talking about, you know, GDP plus, I'm talking serious organic growth rates, double digit, for decades. You've got to be an operation execution machine. You've got to know new products. You've got to be good at R&D. It's super difficult. And this also links to one of my favorite Buffett quotes, not to turn this podcast into a Buffett fanboy session, but where he says something along the lines of that some businesses just shouldn't grow. And that's fine. And actually, Berkshire were happy to buy businesses that don't grow if they earn enough cash to warrant the price. And then obviously if that cash flow is durable, because they can redeploy that cash elsewhere. And so I think that this concept of it's okay if you can't grow organically, if you can buy quality businesses with durable cash flow and you have a process, a rigorous, disciplined capital allocation process to take that cash flow and redeploy it elsewhere, i.e. inorganic growth, you know, that's fascinated me. And I think businesses like Halma and LIFCO, you know, at least from until now, they've mastered that or cracked that over time, and many other companies have as well. And I think part of our core research has been to explore how and why they've done that, when it goes wrong, why it works, and how each company has a slightly different approach on that overarching strategy.
Let's look at why these two companies in particular lend themselves to a very fruitful benchmarking exercise. And there's two parts to this. One we've covered in an earlier episode, in an earlier piece on operations. This piece in particular relates to M&A. Let's get into that.
Well, I think this whole string of research, I think the original observation was, how the hell is LIFCO so lean? Which, you know, they have three people at HQ, I think literally, and they do 2 billion euros in revenue. And so at LIFCO HQ, you've got Per, the CEO. He's got a right-hand man, which is, he's also kind of like an operating group manager, i.e. manages, I think he's involved in managing or oversees a bunch of operating subsidiaries. And then the CFO, right? That's their HQ for a 2 billion euro business, which I haven't seen. I mean, it's probably, you know, the closest you're going to get to it is probably Berkshire in a way, in its different style, but Yeah, that's pretty incredible for a business doing 400 million plus in operating income to have three people at HQ. No HR, no sustainability team, no overheads, for better or for worse, but that's how they're structured. And so that, like, how is that possible? And they're still growing organically, high returns on capital, and organic revenue and operating income is also growing healthily, and actually more so than these other holdcos. So the original observation was, how is it possible that Lifco can run a business this way? And then the comparison to Halma came mainly because I've studied Halma for years, because it's UK based, you know, it's been going since it's been public since the '80s, so you've got a long track record of it. But secondly, it's just perfect because they're very identical in size. I mean, you know, Halma's 2 billion in revenue too. And similar margin profile, 20%+ operating margins. And again, has grown organically, both revenue and operating income over long periods of time. And they also traded at similar multiples, at least when we've done this work, in terms of EV over EBITA, right? So a kind of capitalizing the adjusted operating income. And so the comparison of the two companies, you have these two businesses that operate a very similar strategy, which is buying quality businesses, decentralized structure, growing the operating assets organically, but redeploying that capital into new acquisitions to drive inorganic growth. The combination of the organic growth and the inorganic growth gets you to, you know, low double-digit revenue growth total, if not a bit higher, depending on the starting date. But the big difference is, obviously, you have this Lifco HQ with three people versus Halma, which has 50 people, you know, 100, you know, 70 odd people. And then it gets even more interesting when you look at how many assets they own. So you have Lifco with three people at HQ doing a similar amount of revenue with 250 subsidiaries, and Halma has just under 50. So you have these two different businesses, completely different org structures, completely different amount of actual operating assets and P&Ls they have to manage. Yet the one with more assets is way leaner than the one with fewer companies. Yet they both kind of generate a similar amount of operating income. And so I think that was the start of the exploration on these two businesses. We you know, in the prior conversation, we studied how we learned around the org structure, so how they're so different. And then when we did learn about the org structure, we realized that actually the whole philosophy of the company is somewhat different, in that it also feeds into the M&A strategy of the businesses and how that's different too. And so from the outside looking in, these businesses are very, you know, quite similar. They deploy a similar strategy, performed actually very well, own kind of similar businesses. Maybe people could argue how my own high quality companies, at least bigger businesses, and therefore potentially high quality or more professional. But they follow a very similar strategy of a real focus on redeploying the capital. Yet the operating philosophy is very different. And I think this is what we focused on this M&A piece of research, where we aim to speak to various people at both companies that were actually employed to buy businesses for Halma and Lifco, and how were they incentivized? That was the core essence of the piece of research.
So we talk a lot about the purpose of fieldwork being to learn something new beyond what is available from a careful reading of all available filings and industry research that we might be able to get our hands on. When it comes to these questions that we explored in these pieces, take us through the journey of your thinking in building up the research case, in working out who you needed to speak to get the information that you suspected would be consequential, in understanding why and how these operating philosophies differ. Let's look at that. Let's look at how you went beyond the filings and structured the primary research learning journey for yourself here?
Well, I think in this case, when exploring how these companies approach M&A, it was fairly clear that we wanted to speak to someone who had been employed in that role at both companies. Now, an understanding of how these businesses were organized was pretty critical with that. And, you know, our prior work on actually exploring, okay, you have Lifco, they have 3 people at HQ. They have 250 companies. Like, imagine having 250 businesses. We have one, it's hard enough. Like, how the hell do you manage 250 businesses with 3 people? So, and obviously, if you look at Lifco's filings, if you go on and you try and source for people outside of, you know, the filings and not, they don't tell you how they're organized. It's not clear. You literally have even the businesses, their websites or on LinkedIn, or they're not necessarily associated with Lifco. So you've got to dig through and find these businesses and then see who's running them. And so I think that a lot of the work, frankly, in this piece of research was, how the hell is Lifco structured? And what we realized is there's a layer, it's clearly a layer between PER and the HQ and the operating systems. You can't have 250 reports, right? So finding those people that sit between that and are that filter for PER and understanding how that works, and then understanding, and then we can then venture and look at the M&A side for how much different, because they explain way more, you know, they're organized by sectors and therefore they have sector teams and they have way more of a, call it a bureaucratic or traditional org structure, I guess still relatively decentralized to the other companies in the FTSE 100 or 250, but is arguably in the holding company world is probably on a different spectrum to Lifco in terms of decentralization. So firstly, you know, that was a lot of work just understanding how to find people that could explain how Lifco operates. And what we realized is that a lot of these people were not describing their titles necessarily, at least publicly, as if based on what they were actually doing, i.e. there are people that work for Lifco that effectively are chairman or manage or are at least responsible for multiple, up to 10, potentially even 15 companies, yet you wouldn't find that listed or blasted everywhere online that they are the CEO or the chairman of these companies, at least not many of them. And so, and that's also quite an odd concept, right, in terms of, and gives you just such a simple question like that gives you a very interesting glimpse into what it's like to work at Lifco. Well, how on earth is it possible for someone to be on the board of 15 businesses? If you have a board meeting every month, the person will be traveling like nonstop. How would he get anything done? And then, okay, so then obviously then, well, the boards are not the same as what you typically classify as a board. Maybe they don't have monthly meetings. Maybe they don't have quarterly meetings. So then that gets you a sense into, you know, both the good and bad potentially of what the governance might be like or what the culture might be like. And so I think that original piece of research on the org structure was a good, you know, 3, 4, even 5 months of work, just understanding and trying to find the right people, speak to the right people. And then once we understood that, we could then explore the M&A side. And so the M&A side at Lifco was also unusual, where PER has, you know, I think 5 or 6, maybe 7 or 8 analysts, we'll call it analysts, that are quasi or at least old brokers, sell side brokers that effectively are now delegated to a certain region, geographic region across Europe to source businesses. And that compares to Halma, which it was much easier to find that structure because, again, there's more M&A people, a clearer structure, and also more people have left Halma for whatever reason, that they have a sector-based M&A team. So they have 3 or 4 sectors. Each sector has an M&A team. You know, it could be 4 to 5 M&A people per sector. And you know, so you've got 15 odd M&A people. And even if they churn and leave every 3, 4 years, you've got a decent supply of people that we could source from. And so the original upfront work was to explore how the hell Lifco operates and what that meant for the philosophy of the business, the culture of the business. And then it got to the interesting part on M&A, where we spoke to M&A people from both sides.
And I want to draw out, like, this, these topics come up as part of a broader stream of work that goes back, some of these streams go back 7, 8, 10 years, right? As you said in your own words, it is fascinating to think about how different kinds of companies approach growth. And it's fascinating to think about how you can grow or outperform your peer group over extended periods of time. And I wanna ask you to go into a bit more detail in what you found that is relevant not just to these businesses, but that is actually really relevant for anyone who's trying to think about and handicap the quality of an organization that takes inorganic growth seriously.
Well, I think that's the challenge, finding those companies that really understand that, and also realizing companies that understand that ex ante, i.e. before they've got to done it for 20 years, is obviously the trick. So I think there's just, I don't know, there's something with public markets, and maybe this is just the way it should be because it's public and therefore it has to grow because there's shareholders, but there's a tendency for people to believe that companies have to grow, and there's also studies and people believe that M&A is bad, and therefore that kind of implies that you have to grow organically, which is just very difficult. And I think it's, I don't know the answer to this, and there are obviously great executors and operational people out there that build products and can expand products and can build operational machines, and obviously different businesses that have like very deep moats that can afford to spend the R&D and CapEx to expand, you know, with like Google and Facebook and Microsoft. But the majority of businesses probably just shouldn't grow and or can't grow organically. And I don't think people can take that, especially public markets. And then also, I think the CEOs and the management teams maybe delude themselves to thinking they can grow organically. And so I think companies and management teams that appreciate that and have a very rigorous capital allocation policy to redeploy cash from other assets, operating businesses, into M&A programmatically, i.e. very systematically, I think that's part of what's attracted me to these holding companies that can compound, whether it's Halma, Lifco, I mean, Berkshire's a similar model, Constellation, you know, etc. And I think that's really the insight. Now, how do you find, you know, obviously the trick is finding these before everyone else and ideally find them early. And that's part of like part of this mission of trying to understand how companies are organized, how they think about incentivizing their operational staff and M&A staff. All of those decisions give you a glimpse into how that person is thinking about building an organization that can compound for a very long period of time. I don't think there's no one golden bullet to this, right, that you can just look at and give you the answer. I think it's many different layers of the organization that give you a sense of whether someone understands that. And obviously the hard part is actually doing it, right? And you've got to buy these businesses and incentivize people correctly and stand the test of time.
It's interesting that I think we speak to many people, operators, investors, looking at these kinds of businesses. And I wonder what you make of this, but as time goes by, you start by looking at like, what's the way to do this and how do you do it and who's the best and how are they the best and what can you, and the more you get into it, and I think this piece really touches on this, and I wonder if you can expand on this, that you have a couple of businesses that defy to an extent benchmarking or defy. The point is there's several ways to climb this mountain, right? And it can be pretty dangerous to start getting into your head that there's, and I think whether it's with business books and the five things that to do to win, right? And the three ways. And actually, a lot of that feels kind of like really unhelpful, right? To think that there's there's just...
Of course. But I guess that these companies, well, firstly, that you know, they're doing $2 billion of revenue. So it depends on, we're only looking, we're comparing them at a point in time, right? So that's, you know, that's one thing. And then there are many differences between the business, which we lay out, in which we explain these pieces, the org structure, the M&A incentivization scheme, and I guess the overall philosophy of the business. But they're also very similar things to the businesses, in that what you could potentially argue are, you know, truths about the companies, and that can stem from, you know, being diligent on how much you pay for these assets, right? And having a decentralized structure. Again, you can argue on the spectrum of decentralization, but broadly they both believe in decentralization. Not issuing equity, right? So there are, if you compare them to the wider corporate market, there are, you know, there are probably more similarities than differences. But then when you get really into it, if you want to build a holding company, there are, you know, there are lots of nuances that actually reflect the, you know, the people and the culture and the philosophy and the history of the organizations. And then I guess the reason also why I explored this is because the challenge with these businesses, and whether it's that's Constellation or Berkshire, there are, as you get bigger, it gets exponentially more difficult. And so that's when potentially these nuances become more important, where it's way difficult to grow. You know, if you want to grow inorganically 10% a year and you're doing 450 million of the operating profit, you're going to acquire 45 million EBIT per year. Well, if you're buying businesses of 4 million, you're going to acquire 10 a year, right? Almar has 50 businesses. Like, are they going to grow? Are they going to acquire 10 a year? They've never acquired 10 a year in their life. So like that's, they're not gonna, so then what you have is that these businesses end up buying bigger companies, right? And that's when you venture into McKinsey land of like, there's, I got synergies, and that's when it becomes destructive M&A, right? So I think that part of the reason why I explored these nuances is not only to try and understand why they've been successful, but also because it helps you understand the potential limitations from here when they're doing $2 billion in revenue.
You've drawn out that there are some broader patterns that can be drawn from this benchmarking that might be applicable elsewhere, but it's worth being really careful about what those are. And as you said, there is discipline in what you're buying, discipline in execution, perhaps clarity in your capital allocation framework, clarity around your approach to, and maybe not issuing shares, capital discipline.
Decentralization is the big ones in that they both buy businesses that they, and again, this is where it gets nuanced, but they typically don't buy them to integrate them, right? They're looking for synergy and stuff like that. But actually, when you get down to it, all of them are way more flexible than that. And They can tuck in businesses to a platform, and so I think there's just, at the end of the day, it's probably just common sense, you know, like good business judgment. But you know, you can't say that in an annual report.
And I think just to draw this out, that there's, you can fall in love with one of these businesses and I think get sucked in sometimes to thinking this is the way, and actually there are many ways, that there are some common patterns. And there's this question that maybe we can, as we move towards the end of this episode, just bring in the extent to which you think management character and values and the actual people have determined how these systems are organized.
Yeah, of course they have, yeah. I mean, in Halma's case, the way it's largely organized is because the former CEO wanted a certain number of reports, and maybe that's the optimal way for Halma and him, but maybe not for others. So I think, you know, that those types of decisions are critical in how a business is organized and therefore scales. And that's kind of also what this piece was around, was Okay, they've been phenomenal. And, you know, objectively, these businesses have been phenomenal, both of them, right? They're factually just two of the highest performing, or in fact, they both are the top performing securities in Sweden and the UK, respectively, over the last 20 years, right? So, you know, they're up there with being the best. Whether that's going to be the case over the next 20 years is the question. And I think understanding, and I'm not saying that there's no silver bullet here with this research, right? Is these are, we're exploring nuances with these two businesses that can help you provide insight into how these businesses work. And so, for example, with the M&A piece, how they incentivize their M&A team gives you a huge amount of information about how they think about creating value. And they're completely different. And given how much they focus on inorganic growth, yet they both incentivize people, their M&A staff. Firstly, they organize them differently, right? Secondly, they pay them differently. And so, you know, with these businesses, two things broadly matter. Assuming you're acquiring the same quality of businesses, which maybe they're not, but I think they broadly are, and they have the CEO that kind of determines that. But the amount of capital you deploy and the multiple you pay are like two pretty critical variables. Then you know, the business obviously has to get signed off by the, in Lifco's case, Per, and Halmer's case, there's more of a, there's four parties involved, the board, the divisional head, the sector head, and, you know, the M&A. So even then, you can see how there's just various different accountabilities, governance, but actually the way the M&A team are paid are completely different. And the way they're organized are completely different. And just who has responsibility and accountability is completely different on the deployment of capital. So understanding that, I think at least, is, maybe I'm way off here, but I think that's important to understanding the growth rate from here in these businesses, or i.e. how much capital they can redeploy for the next 20 years.
And that speaks to this central question, which is, how do these systems evolve and keep going and keep performing as they scale?
Well, you see what Constellation do. They spin these out and create new groups. And so there's various differences, I think, in this piece that come out that are important for someone to understand in the nuances of the org structure, how they organize people, a bit of the history about why they may be organized in that way. And like you mentioned about Andrew Wilkinson in terms of the personal dynamics of how a business is organized. And then also the M&A side on if you are serious and it's a core part of your strategic plan to redeploy capital to grow, i.e. inorganic growth, understanding how the M&A team are incentivized could help in understanding the future of that business.
Let's wrap this up by talking about what else, what other threads we're pulling on in this more operations-oriented research as it relates to serial acquirers, industrial holding companies.
Well, just brief, there's still work to be done on, potentially on the M&A side, because it's not too clear, right? Like, how do you incentivize an M&A team? These two companies have a completely different method. And maybe that's not a perfect apples to apples because they have a completely different org structure. But let's say you work for an M&A team, therefore your role is to buy businesses, right? You buy a business, let's say for argument's sake, you buy it at 5x normalized operating income. How do you get paid? Like, how should I incentivize you? Do I incentivize you on the amount of capital you deploy, i.e., you know, let's say for Lifco, they obviously want to grow more. The more companies they could buy, all else equal, all else, you know, the quality is equal, at 5x operating income, the better. So, you know, capital deployed's got to be a variable. The multiple's got to be a variable, potentially. Or do you have any control over the multiple? Are you negotiating that? Or do you have an influence in how you find maybe off-market deals versus brokered deals, therefore it impacts them more? So, you know, there's a lot of, and let's say you do buy that business for 5x, you know, we have to decide between how you get compensated, capital deployed, multiple paid. But how do you work that out as a percentage of what, right? Of, do you work out a, you know, some companies work out a year one return, right? So they might say, okay, if let's say for argument, you know, back to this example that you pay 5x, the enterprise value is 5 times the normalized operating income. That's a 20% year one yield if they maintain that rate, right? Well, let's say you've got a cost of capital minus that, and then you get a year one return. Do you get paid a portion of that return? Other companies, they work out some kind of terminal value of that business, because, you know, Lifco doesn't value these assets at 5x. Lifco is a 40x multiple, but they might say, actually, do you know what? This is worth 10x to us, right? So the M&A guy buys it at 5x. You know, the value, terminal value, they both agree is 10x, and then they create... That's created that much of enterprise value for the business. And then you get a very small portion of that. I've seen some companies do that, which is a slightly more generous, well, more than slightly, but it's a more generous way to compensate M&A staff. So I think that exploration of how companies pay M&A staff is actually an ongoing project. And, you know, we done that work last year, I think it was last year, on Constellation Software, and how they're seeing a lot of M&A staff leave. And, you know, part of the reason why they left is because they were relatively underpaid to what they could get elsewhere. And, you know, they have a escrow scheme where part of their bonus can be paid in shares. And but a lot of people weren't happy about that and how much they got paid. So I don't think it's not necessarily an easy task to incentivize these staff. And yeah, it can encourage really, you know, unaligned behavior if you've got people that are trying to deploy lots of capital at bad prices, or frankly, you know, the inverse could be true. You could be buying stuff at 5x or 4x multiple that's just crap, right? It doesn't last a few years. So I think that's still a huge part of the work. And then we'll also do some research on how different companies operate these assets and go deeper into these entities to understand really how they look to grow them. You know, a big part of these businesses is how you, if you're assuming that these companies take the cash flow from these assets and redeploy them elsewhere, how do you ensure those assets get enough capital to grow? If they have got a capital expenditure program that they need, or an R&D project where it needs a bit of capital, how do you have that conversation? How do you have that framework that ensures that you have, you know, you're comparing taking the capital from that business and deploying it elsewhere versus reinvesting it in that company. And that's also an art that I think is quite tricky.
I want to bring a last element in so that we avoid the risk of, you said, I think we've avoided the risk that this became a Buffett fanboy chat. Let's also avoid the risk that this becomes a serial acquirer fanboy chat. We've published historically on StoreScorgon. Add a little about some of the topics on your mind that might foreshadow what's coming up over the next year around failure modes for these institutions, and which situations we're quite interested in following, where the attempt to grow inorganically over extended periods of time has not worked.
I mean, there are also plenty of those that
right. There's
never. I mean, we looked at SDI briefly, and again, you know, whether that's, these are still in motion, right, and they're still evolving. Obviously, they've been really challenged and struggled for a number of years. But StoreScorgon, SDI Group, there's a few others out there, and also probably get around to writing something on that. But you know, they each have their own challenges, and you know, StoreScorgon, again, probably tried to acquire too many companies far too quickly. And also had people doing M&A that didn't necessarily were incentivized or aligned with the business. SDI Group was a different case where it also shows you how difficult it is to scale these businesses beyond, you know, a certain size. And you know, if you're trying to do one transaction a month, that's a lot. You need to know what you're buying and have the infrastructure to do that, and doing that lean is pretty incredible. So again, just goes back to full circle and just how incredible Lifco actually is.
Yeah, just how how much or how just extremely the businesses we've ended up focusing on are very unusual. They're really outliers. Like this actually is, I don't know how you feel about it, but it's pretty hard to do well over extended. I guess it's pretty hard to do anything well over a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, if the fastest way to blow up a company is just redeploy the capital into loads of crap. this is the easiest way to blow something up, which probably scares most people, right?
While looking smart short term, right? Because top line's growing, right? And you know,
and funny enough, like aligned with that is the most read article last year was on purchase price accounting, which is like the accounting policy you use when you buy assets, and so it's also probably the easiest way to do accounting fraud as well for most companies. So there are very legitimate reasons why people don't look at this stuff, and probably should run a million miles from it.
And I like that you've said that. I wanted that out of your mouth as part of this episode. Which is
it's the easiest way to blow stuff up, and it's the easiest way to do accounting fraud. Like, so forget everything we've just said for the last 45
minutes. Basically, avoid these businesses for as long as you possibly can. There's a few that make it; they're few and far between, and it's mostly a waste of your time.
On that note, we shall end.
See you next week.
As always, this is for informational purposes only, and should not be relied upon for investment decisions. Please do your own research.